Guys, Nathan For You continues its new season on Comedy Central. Nathan Fielder is the comedian who brought you Dumb Starbucks and Pig Saves Goat. And he's back with more outlandish ideas to help real small businesses. This season is his most ambitious yet. And again, it's called Nathan For You. It airs on Comedy Central Thursdays at 10, 9 Central, or anytime on the Comedy Central app. Hey, have you guys heard The Message? The new podcast. It follows Nikki Tomlin, a PhD in linguistics from the University of Chicago, who is working on deciphering an alien message from over 70 years ago. This 8-episode podcast series will blow your scientific mind as you follow the story of Nikki as he works with a team of cryptologists at a research think tank called Cypher to try to decode a message received from outer space 70 years ago. Don't miss a second of this new modern-day War of the Worlds podcast from GE Podcast Theater and Panoply called The Message. Subscribe today to The Message on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Yeah. Jumpin', them boys up to something. They just spent like 2 or 3 weeks out the country. Them boys up to something, they just not just bluffing. You don't have to call, I hear my dance like Usher. Ooh. I just found my tempo like on DJ Mustard. Ooh. I hit that Ginobili with my left hand, though, like, woo. Lobster and saline for all my babies that I miss. Hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name's Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked, and we're listening to Jumpman, 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 off the Drake Future collabo mixtape, which I've been playing nonstop recently. I don't know if it's really good. I feel like I might look back and be like, really? But both of these guys are having kind of a huge moment right now. It's called What a Time to Be Alive, and that's, I think, an appropriate sentiment and an appropriate album to start us off this week, because we're talking about man-made objects and how they relate to the moment in which they're invented. We always hear about visionary inventors seeing years into the future and plucking some futuristic technology out of that world and bringing it back to us, but there's a second type that we don't hear that much about, which we're calling screwdrivers. So a brief history of the invention of the screwdriver. For thousands of years, we put stuff together with nails, which, you know, held things together reasonably well. But we've all seen boards that are sort of like bowing away from the thing they're supposed to be connected to. And those never have screws sticking out of them. It's always nails. So after a while, the carpenters being like, great work, nails. You had one job, and instead of doing it, you turned into a stab board. This will not do, some enterprising carpenter said, and they invented screws. And carpenters were like, whoa, now we're talking. So the modern screws we have today with the slots in the top first start showing up in the 1500s, and so of course humanity realized we need something to do the screwing. Your mother and I can't do all the work, and so of course the screwdriver was invented 300 years later. Which, what? That doesn't make any sense. I'm being you here. How now, you surely jest me, good sir. That's right, I guessed your reaction word for word. But the reason that's surprising is because we tend to think of inventions being ahead of their time, and we're going to talk about those types of inventions plucked from the future and delivered to us decades before we have any right to own them. We'll be calling those inventions iPhones. But today we're mostly talking about the second type that don't get much press, the inventions that are behind their time, that are long overdue. They were staring humanity in the face for hundreds of years. And this is how progress happens more often than we might think or want to admit. And actually, there's a third type of invention that I thought of after the conversation that are probably worth mentioning here because I think they kind of fill out the picture. I'll call these inventions asteroid movies. You have screwdrivers, iPhones, and asteroid movies. And asteroid movies are inventions that are invented at their exact right time, exactly on schedule. And you can tell these inventions because they get invented by multiple people at the same time. There's a past episode of this podcast, actually, with Christy Harrison and
David Wong, where we talked about the phenomenon of simultaneous invention. For instance, we know the telephone was invented by Alexander Graham Bell, but on the day he filed the patent for his telephone, another inventor working completely independently of him filed a patent for a working telephone, a guy named Elijah Gray. They both filed patents for working telephones on February 14th, 1876. So for all of human history, no telephone. On February 14th, 1876, two guys filed a patent for working telephones. But we're naming them asteroid movies because of 1998, the year two movies about an asteroid came out. I think Jason explained that there was some big news story 20 years earlier about an asteroid that passed within a couple hundred million miles of Earth. And that idea that an asteroid could hit Earth was germinating in the minds of probably everyone who saw that news report until someday in the early 90s when all of them at once were like, that would make a great movie. And then most of them then apologized to the guy who they were collecting the toll from when they shouted, they should make asteroid movie, or, you know, went back to their job buffing the floors of an elementary school. But two of the thousands of people that idea occurred to happened to be screenwriters, and they went and pitched it to two studios, and the rest is history, assuming the movie's deep impact and Armageddon go down in history, like I expect them to. But Hollywood's actually full of examples of two movies going into production at the same time with the same basic premise, but usually there's only room in the zeitgeist for one of them, which is why you've heard of Capote and not Infamous. But both Deep Impact and Armageddon were monster hits. Those writers had the same idea at the same time, and the world was so ready for that idea that they just gobbled both those movies up. It was like the world was playing a game of double dutch, and they both just jumped right in on beat and did a sick high five and found a way to not trip over each other. Anyways, that's the premise of this episode. The world is a game of double dutch, and you can jump in right on beat like the asteroid movies. You can show up late and spend 300 years trying to screw things in with your bare hands or whatever carpenters did, which, better late than never, or you can be ahead of your time, and hopefully the world is grateful that you've gifted them with this little piece of the future, like the iPhone. I'll be back at the end for some footnotes, but first, my discussion with Tom and Alex about inventions that came before or after their time. Talk to you in a bit.
Heard they came through Magic City on a Monday. Heard they had the club wild, it was star-studded. A bunch of girls going wild when your chain flooded. And I had them lighting wild, cup dudded. Dope man, dope man, dope man, dope man, dope man, dope man.
All right, I'm joined by Mr. Alexander Schmidt, goes by Schmitty on the street.
Yeah, how's it going?
And Tom Ryman.
Yep.
What's up?
Hey, what's going on?
So we're talking about screwdrivers and iPhones. We'll call it the screwdriver iPhone theory. So screwdrivers refer to the fact that screwdrivers were invented after screws. So they invented screws. Mm,
but that doesn't make any sense.
Exactly. They invented screws and then just spent 50 years being like, God, what? These things are so hard to get into things. Same deal with can openers, cans and can openers. Cans were invented for preserving food, and then can openers were invented 45 years later. So for 45 years, soldiers would stab the cans with bayonets. That was the way to get it open. And then they also had a can opener that was so dangerous that you had to just like go to the grocery store to get your cans
There's
open.
There's only one can opener in the entire village.
Right. Yeah, right. Exactly.
Only one man
the guy was
can
like,
be trusted with
all right, everybody stand back and put on like a welding
yeah,
mask or something.
Goggles.
Yeah.
And the can opener operator was like, this will be a job I can get paid to do forever. Yeah. This will never be obsolete.
The sliced bread one, this is all from an article by Jacques Linton, Grammy Milling, and Laura H. on Cracked, that ran earlier this month. It's one of my favorite articles we've had in a while and just really changed the way I think about a lot of human history, as we call it, human history. But one thing that it cleared up for me is the phrase greatest invention since sliced bread. I was always like, why is sliced bread such a great invention? Like, what the...
That is
like,
a weird...
Settle down, Grandma.
It does seem like a folksy idiom that... It doesn't seem like it's an actual thing, but apparently that was a genuine invention.
It was like...
somebody figured out, we should cut this.
Yeah, it was like the iPhone of the early 20th century, essentially. They had to outlaw it when it was first invented because the demand on wheat was such that, like, the economy couldn't take it. They were like, look, just quit it with the sliced bread for a little while. The people are, like,
we
rioting.
We have to recover.
Yeah. There's been five grocers just torn apart limb from limb, like in a zombie movie.
I love that cutting bread devastated the ecosystem, right. Like, agriculturally. Like, they were like, no, we need some time to recover.
Right. Bread's been around since the Bible.
Yeah, forever.
And we've just been, like, as we say in the article, just sticking it in our mouths like a wood chipper. There's three more examples like that that are just bizarre that you can read the article to get. But we're going to talk about some other examples just from human history, because that's just not how we expect progress to happen. Out of order, ass backwards, I guess. And I had listened to two podcasts recently that I felt like kind of created this dichotomy of iPhones versus screwdrivers. The iPhone was just listening to a bunch of interviews with Steve Jobs and his biographer, where it was like, he knew he had to invent the iPhone from like a really early time. And everyone was like, what are you talking about? Just use C prompts. This is how computers will work. And he was like, no, you fucking idiots. He was also like stealing all the best ideas from other people, but he was using them to construct this thing that it was just like his single-minded purpose to create basically smartphones. So that's like an example of an invention that happens the way sort of that we expect inventions to happen, where it's like a genius inventor comes up with this idea years in advance of when we should have had it. We shouldn't have had smartphones for another 100 years.
But right.
Like, we're just walking around with these fucking televisions in our pockets that are just like fucking amazing. And we shouldn't have had that until 2300,
like,
at least.
Future movies from like the 70s, even like the future technology they imagined we would have in like the 22nd century is not as advanced as an iPhone.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
It's like anytime I've seen illustrations of like retro future, kind of what people predicted, and there will be a flying car and what their version of like it's a mobile portable TV phone, and the car looks amazing and the phone looks terrible.
Yeah, it's some jackass stupid thing like a helmet. I'm like, no, nobody's gonna walk around wearing a helmet.
Yeah, and I think that's how a lot of stuff happens. Like, I think we'll talk about motion pictures later, and I think once the idea was invented, Edison like took it and ran with it and like really improved it, and he was like Steve Jobs in that he stole good ideas from everywhere and just like kind of threw them together with other good ideas until they were awesome technologies that were way ahead of their time. And that's kind of how we think of inventions taking place, but it is interesting to think, wow, how many years ahead of schedule was this innovation? I think the iPhone's a great example of one that was far ahead. And then there are these other innovations that are screwdrivers that are like staring humanity in the face for hundreds of years. And we're just like, duh, but I don't know. Like, it just takes us fucking forever to get our head around
it. Like doors. I wonder how long it took us to figure that
out. Right. Well, doorknobs were invented. Like Abraham Lincoln, we've talked about, I think on a past podcast, but Abraham Lincoln never saw a doorknob, never used a doorknob.
Right, and he didn't know what like minutes were, right? Because it was something like they only invented that
no,
to
they
keep...
knew it.
Well, I mean, like they told time in like quarter hours instead of down to the minute. Like they only invented that for train schedules, right?
Because they didn't have good enough.
They only invented standardized time once trains were invented, because before that, it was just like whatever time is, it is right now. So like people would adjust their pocket watch by like where the sun was in the sky, and like that was the time. You know, like as long as you're in my household, it's 5 o'clock.
Right, it could be 2 hours in the future in the next town. It's just like nobody's keeping these clocks.
Yeah, exactly. It was whatever time your specific town center's clock said it was, and then trains were invented, so we needed to make sure that all those different town square clocks were in agreement with one another.
That's a pretty good screwdriver, right?
Right, yeah, that's a great
nobody
screwdriver.
Knew what the fuck time it was.
Right, it was just, a general indicator of how soon the sun was setting, which kind of makes sense, like, in terms of convenience, but it is interesting that, like, we have all those westerns where it's like shoot out at high noon, and like that was just arbitrary, like when high noon was.
Yes, whenever.
I'm now imagining like the guy who was in charge of the can opener was also the guy in charge of time, was also in charge, like he was in in charge of everything. That
right, because they would all be located.
Became everyone's job.
Yeah, at like the town center.
At town center, yeah. The grocer who's like yells out what time it is on his pocket watch.
Right. Hope you don't want to use the one phone, because I'm using it.
Right.
The guy who has all the stuff.
No, hope you don't want to use the one fax machine. That's another entry from the article that fax machines were invented before phones, shockingly.
Oh, yeah.
Fax machines have been around forever and just been ignored forever. Everyone's just like, these fucking suck. Like, come on. We can do better than this, right? Make a phone, for God's sakes.
It's still like a miracle piece of technology. We're like, well, this is kind of the shitty version. We already knew it was like the shittiest version of it.
Yeah.
Like, as soon as it was invented.
Can't this
like
just be picture. An email that we haven't invented yet?
The thing, in addition to this article, that made me think about this is another podcast that was an episode of Radiolab called Smile My Ass. You should go listen to it. But it's about the invention of Candid Camera and like how Candid Camera sort of invented this idea of reality television in the first place. But what struck me was how circuitous and like roundabout the invention of this idea was. So it started with this guy who was in charge of the communications division of the military during World War II, just one small location. And he invented this radio show where troops would like gripe about stuff like, ah, my wife's sleeping with some fella back home. And
this is Alan Funt?
Yeah, the food's terrible here. So he invents this show, but he notices that he'll have great conversations during the brainstorm with the troops. But then once the red light turns on, the troops just like seize up the way Tom does. No, I'm just sure. No, once the red light goes on, they all seize up. So he just disconnected the red light and was like, all right, so let's rehearse. Like, what are you going to say? It's actually also what Clint Eastwood does. Clint Eastwood allegedly will shoot by being like, all right, let's just get a rehearsal. And then people do the rehearsal and he's like, all right, got it. And like never does it again.
Yeah,
that's how they got George C. Scott in Dr. Strangelove, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, didn't they? Because George C. Scott wanted to play like a very serious, not cartoony general. And then Kubrick was like, okay, we'll do like the gag version.
Do like a fun one.
Rolling, 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 rolling. Like,
what is the stupidest possible way? Like, let's make fun of the way that you like, think.
Okay, that was good. Now, how would an asshole say
that? So that's the first idea is he gets this, oh, you can get people to be candid if they don't know they're being recorded. So
right, they'll be very candid on camera. Well, not a camera yet.
On
microphone.
So then, like, after the war, he has five kids or whatever people did after the war. Kisses a nurse in Times Square.
Five kids, seven Cadillacs, three homes.
Yeah, exactly.
Minimum.
And then, you know, while mowing his lawn, gets the idea, oh, say that thing that I did for the troops back in World War II. Maybe that would make a swell radio program. And so he invents Candid Microphone. But this is an amazing thing. So the version of the show he tries to invent, he just will like stick a microphone in a plant, like in the women's room, and then just be like, all right, now let's hear what they say.
He started this program where he illegally records people's conversations.
Right. And just expects them to be interesting.
Right.
And it's just snippets of conversation of people being like, well, he was being kind of an asshole, huh? And then Alan Funt comes on and be like, whoa. Like, you believe she called some random stranger an asshole who you don't know?
He thought people... I guess he imagined everyone at all times just like a font of hilarious, amazing improv.
So then eventually they get this idea to razz people up. I forget what they say. Some old-timey word for like get people's blood up. So they like invent the idea of like putting them in funny situations, which took them, I think, like a couple years to get that idea. A couple years of just dreadful programming.
Horrible programming.
Yeah, just like overheard conversations forever.
Really, meanwhile, it's a miracle they stayed on the air.
Meanwhile, the amazing thing about this is that there's this great journalist who went out and just like interviewed people during the Depression, and he's like a radio journalist, and it's like, that guy already invented the idea of prompting people to speak. How did you not put that together? If we like just get them to say stuff rather than expecting them to just say stuff,
sure, arrive like, at it on their own,
it might be interesting. Like someone had basically already invented this in the guise of news, but he couldn't put that together. Alan Funt kind of comes off looking like a dumbass in this story, but
he doesn't look like the most learned man when you watch Candid Camera.
Right. Yeah, believe it or not. So anyways, they finally get the idea, and like they have some episodes where they hire a guy, a mover, to come move a chest, and then Alan Funt is in the chest moaning, and the mover's like, "Say, fella, what's in there?" And he's like, "Hey, don't bother with what's in there. You just move it, huh?" And that's the show, but it was wildly successful because nobody had ever heard a prank before. And the episode's weird. If you do listen to the episode, it's weird because they're like, Alan Funt makes the greatest eerie moaning sound, and then you hear it, and he's like, "Oh!" It's like not eerie at all. It just sounds like a guy's...
Sounds like a guy trying on underpants.
Yeah. So the definition of eerie has changed since then.
Yeah. But that's a, people scared easier back then. Yeah.
Anyways, then TV becomes more of a thing, and they invent this show called Candid Camera, and it's a dud... because everybody thinks it's mean-spirited because all they show is the prank and they edit out the reveal where they're like, look, you're on Candid Camera, and the person's like, and smiles and is like cool with it. Rather than showing people that the person is cool with it, they just show the prank happen right up until the person gets so angry that they have to stop it, and then they cut. So they spent 3 years with this fledgling, failing TV show editing out the one thing that eventually would make it a huge hit. Alan Funt coming in and being like, "Hey, there's a hidden camera over there. You're at Smile. You're on Candid Camera." So eventually they figured that out and it became a hit. And it did kind of invent reality TV.
Absolutely.
In that sense. So Cops gets a lot of credit for it. And Tom, you pointed out that I think Cops came about...
because there was a writer's strike. The guy who developed it had done a few years earlier in the early 80s. He was doing some investigative report or something with a police unit. I think it was about the drug war or something. Anyways, he was filming a bunch and he's like, "This would make a really awesome TV show." Like just follow these dudes around on their job. And he tried to sell it for a long time and he really couldn't. Until like the end of the 80s, they had this big writer strike and Fox needed shows that didn't need to be scripted. So they're like, "Well, we'll do this because it doesn't need to be written.
We'll throw this bullshit on the air."
Yeah, put this bullshit on TV.
Like closed their eyes and hid their face as the first one aired.
Like even that idea took him a little bit because his original idea was still going to have, it was the same sort of thing as a Candid Camera. It still took him a long time to arrive at this very simple idea because he wanted it to like follow the cops home and into their home life. So there was still going to be like this. Yeah, there was still going to be like this scripted portion where it was going to be like partially like a sitcom.
Oh, they would script that part and
I believe so.
I could see it. That's yeah, crazy.
But he wanted to take it into like their homes and have that be a major part of the show. And
what
then,
a terrible fucking idea.
Right, it would have been so bad.
Alex, you're being way too kind to that. You're like, okay. Yeah, I'm sure that wouldn't have fucked with the cops' like ability to like keep their heads small. They'd be like going out just like shooting people and then like turning to the camera.
And you're also showing everybody in the nation where these cops live and what their family looks like.
Yeah.
So it's like, but then they figured that out. And then what you were saying about shows like The Real World and like Road Rules, they just needed to find that X factor of I want to be famous, so I'll agree to do anything. It was also all those talk shows in the 90s that blew up.
I think that's the key thing is that once you show the people finding out that they're on camera and Candid Camera, that's what made us okay with sort of judging them essentially and like laughing at them.
We had to be able to feel okay with ourselves.
It was... for laughing at them. And that's what happens with reality TV. Like Cops was somewhat popular. It was kind of a rage because we had never seen unscripted TV before. But eventually it faded out because it was like kind of mean-spirited and like awful. And you're just seeing these horrible things happen to really destitute people.
Yeah.
But the thing that was added to it a few years later with Real World was that all those people were like looking into the camera and being like, "Hey, I'm Eric, and I'm going to be a star." Like, you know, that's the sense you
they
got.
They would show, like, some horrible, like, them getting into some drunken fight, and they're like, "Yeah, that was crazy." Like, so they buy it back for us, so it makes it all right.
And even the early Real Worlds are, like, sort of cinema verite style. Like, we're just a fly on the wall with these ordinary people, and then Real World only gets good the way it is today.
The more that they,
The more that they just get clearly fame-hungry, like, drunk-ass maniacs.
Yeah, they put them in a house and fill it with booze.
Right.
And with all these shows, it's amazing that they were able to, like, it seems like they were able to trial and error discover every aspect of it, thing by thing, which it must just be a product of TV needed stuff for a long time. Like, before cable, channels just needed things on them. And so you could just
programming.
You could just constantly fail until you figured out what the show was to make.
Yeah, I think TV might just be run by dumb people. Hey, give us a TV show, though.
so I'm watching her fine ass walk to my bedroom and thought to myself, that's the shape of things to come. She said, why in the club you don't make it precipitate, you know, make it rain when you can make it thunderstorm.
Hello again, we're riding into the ads on The Art of Storytelling Part 4, which is a song I missed the first time around because it came out on some dude named Drama's album in 2007, 4 years after the last Outkast album. So in case you missed it yourself, I wanted to share it with you. I'll explain whether it's a screwdriver or an iPhone in the footnotes, but first, enjoy these words from our sponsors.
Then I tell it how it could be, the hood be requesting my services. Oh, don't get nervous, it's step your game of time. These ain't them same old rhymes designed to have you dancing in some club. Niggas ride to me, women be off in they tub, exfoliating with they pom-poms, yelling, go 3,000. I'm in my whatever, bumping 100 miles. And
this episode of the Crack Podcast is sponsored by Casper Mattresses, which is perfect because this week we're talking about inventions where humanity collectively was like, holy shit, where was this all along? And this is basically how I feel about Casper mattresses after they sent me one a few months ago. I feel like beds throughout history were pretty shitty in my experience. They were made of leaves or down or goat skin back when I was a kid. I'm a Highlander. I have been alive for hundreds of years. Then in the late 19th century, metal spring mattresses came along and we thought we had the whole sleeping thing figured out. And then all of a sudden, bam, out of nowhere, the Steve Jobs of sleeping comes around and combines latex foam with memory foam, and the whole technology of sleep jumps ahead a few hundred years in one instant. So what are you doing on your old-timey rotary phone mattress? Get the smartphone of mattresses, you guys. And here's the deal Casper has for you. All their mattresses are extremely reasonably priced to begin with. $500 for a twin, up to just $950 for a king, and trust me, we were actually in the market for a new mattress when Casper offered to send us one, and that is like super cheap. That's basically half the price of other mattresses. And if you go to casper.com/cracked and use cracked at checkout, you can get $50 off any of their mattresses. Also, awesomely, they deliver the mattress straight to you, and if you don't like it within 100 days, they pick it right back up. Give them a try. I promise you'll start sleeping better. Again, that's casper.com/cracked and enter promo code cracked to let them know who sent you. Hey guys, this week's episode is also sponsored by lynda.com. Have you been looking for a new job and the application has like all sorts of insane requirements, like you need to know C++, Java, Final Cut Pro, and, you know, 16th century agrarian business economics? So you've probably heard me talk about Lynda a lot lately, but it's because I think they're actually really super useful, especially if you're looking for a job right now. They have over 3,000 courses on topics like web development, audio production, visual design, business, and basically any software you might need in the modern world. You can't time travel back to the 16th century and use their courses, unfortunately. So the next time a position has really intimidating requirements like that, instead of forgetting about the job, you can just head over to Lynda and learn it all in a day, like Neo uploading Kung Fu. So here's the offer I got for you. Go to lynda.com/cracked and you can get a 10-day free trial with unlimited access to all of the courses on lynda.com, plus unlimited access to watch on your iPhone or Android device. So do something good for yourself. Learn something new and start a 10-day free trial at lynda.com/cracked. That's lynda.com/cracked. What are some other examples? I think we had some good ones.
We talked about TV. We could do movies.
Yeah. Hey, TV media. Movies. People like those.
Yeah, you're onto something.
So the idea of the motion picture, right? It's insane. The story of the first motion picture that was ever invented is a completely fucking insane story. It was like basically a bet between two guys who were like, I bet you that a horse never has all four hooves in the air. And the other guy was like, I bet it does have all four hooves in the air sometimes. And the other guy was like, that's impossible, because they didn't know how gravity worked,
right?
Apparently.
Motion.
Yeah, they just like didn't know how physics worked. And so the way that motion pictures are invented is that stupid of a bet happens to two guys who are rich enough to be like, okay, I'm going to station 20 cameras along the edge of a horse track.
You almost had it right. You were about to say like photographic devices, which is what they would have said. I'm going to station 20 photo chambers. Right.
20 of those guys under a big black hood camera.
This is like the end of the 19th century. And Edison sees these two dipshits like being like, look at it, look at this thing.
Look at it, the horse is moving.
Right, they're in the center of Manhattan being like, I told you about the horse hooves. And Edison's just like, what are these two fucking idiots doing? And he's like, oh, wow, that's the future.
He's like, how can I use that to my advantage?
Right.
He's like, that's the future. And they're like, I know, we could look at so many other animals running. Right, we could figure out how ducks run. We could figure out how tigers run.
Right, we could figure out if bear, children. All four bear paws are off the ground. Bears. Yeah, how children run. Yeah. Yeah. So Edison invents the motion picture device, or enslaves a bunch of inventors and puts them in his invention dungeon and prods them with hot irons until they invent a motion picture device. And he patents the fuck out of it because Edison was a great, you know,
that was his MO.
He was a great business mind, which just means that he was a sociopathic predator.
Right. Like, that's it's the like thing. Both him, because you used him and Steve Jobs. It seems like both of these dudes got a really cursory visit from a time traveler. Not like enough to tell them all the useful information they would need to actually build all the shit that Edison has or the iPhone for Jobs, but just enough to tell them, you're going to be an amazing inventor. This is what you're going to invent.
Right.
And then leaves.
They had five photographs. They're like, here's what the future will look like. Here's what the future will look like. Here's what the future will look like. And they're just like, God, but I'm not very smart. And then just like went around being like stealing ideas from
but I can steal it from weaker people.
Right, right. Exactly.
Just imagine them walking around the world holding a picture of what they're going to invent and like looking back and forth at things.
Like that's not it. No, nope, nah, that's not it.
Keeps punching Wozniak in his stomach. Do it right.
Anyways, Edison, his patent is good in, I think, New Jersey and the two states that had been invented at that point.
Right.
I don't know. So, as you mentioned, Alex, some genius is like, oh, fuck, let's just go to California. There's nothing out there.
Yeah, there's a weird thing where very early in American filmmaking, it's all centered on Fort Lee, New Jersey, which is not the city you think of as Hollywood today. And for all kinds of reasons, partly Edison being a dick, it's like a place people could work. But at the time, if you wanted to make a movie in the 1910s, like D.W. Griffith was in Fort Lee, New Jersey. Mary Pickford was in Fort Lee. All these people you think of as old silent movie people. Yeah, and then in 1911, this guy David Horsley builds a studio right around what's Sunset and Gower, if you know LA, in Hollywood. But there was nothing there at the time. And by moving to Hollywood, you could get out from under Edison's boot, which was what Horsley was doing, because Edison was like, no, you can't have the patent to use my stuff. And so he left. You can also have sunshine all the time, so you can shoot outdoors whenever you want. And also just nothing had been built in the city. Land was cheap. And he did that in 1911. And then by around 1930, there were Paramount, MGM, Fox, Warner, RKO, which isn't a thing anymore. But by 1930, they all had studios. They all had theaters that they owned. It took only a few years to build that whole motion picture industry out here in LA. Because what a great idea that was staring people in the face. The whole time they were trying to shoot what looked like the Wild West in the Palisades in New Jersey.
Right.
Which is a horrible way to do it.
Right. Is his name Horsley?
Yeah, David Horsley. Yeah.
He only got into it because he was like, motion pictures. Right. Say, that's the thing that takes all those pictures of the horses.
He was actually a horse with a mustache.
Like and he built a studio in Hollywood in 1911, and then Carl Laemmle, who started Universal, bought him out the next year because, like, oh my God, great idea. Why have I been in New Jersey this whole time? Like, there's all this land out here and it's nice and Edison's nowhere to be seen, and what a great idea. It's like, why did I not do that in the first place?
And it took them so long to figure that. And then when they finally, that one guy goes out there, they're all like, wait, what the fuck is that guy doing? Oh, we should have been, oh my God, oh, why are we hanging around?
Where did he get a son?
It's such an obvious answer because the patent is only
Well, and there were other places people tried to go, and there was this place, it's called Hobe Sound, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, in Florida. It's by like Jupiter and Port St. Lucie on the east side of Florida, but they tried to rebrand it as Picture City in the 20s was the name, which is the most 1920s name for anything.
Picture City.
And they were like, great, obviously Florida is sunny, is not by Edison, what a perfect place to do it, but they do have hurricanes there, and in 1928 a Category 4 hurricane like wiped out everything they were working on, and they were like, oh, let's never do this again.
Okay,
let's,
this is a bad idea. It's a terrible idea, obviously. It's a terrible version of this idea.
But it's, besides getting out from Edison, it's like a resource you don't think about is just having cheap land and sunshine makes all kinds of filmmaking possibilities a thing you can do.
It's interesting. All of the screwdrivers that we've been talking about were things that, like, once invented, sliced bread broke the American economy. They just couldn't bear the demand. And once Horsley had the idea to make a motion picture in L.A., everyone was like, oh, holy shit, and like built the entire city out there. It's kind of interesting. I wonder if the whole East Coast is basically like that, because still California is pretty underdeveloped. And I mean, I guess it's because water is so rare out here. But like when you drive up the West Coast, it's just like arid desert between San Francisco and Los Angeles, but the East Coast is just like jam-packed with all these cities that were built up in these horrifying climates. It's just like, yeah, that's where they landed.
That's where we landed. Yeah, right. Might as well.
So, yeah, so you just put it down right there in that bay.
Yeah.
That was an Indian
settlement. Well, I don't want to walk.
Yeah. A couple really big screwdrivers that we were emailing about. Alex, you had mentioned healthcare.
Yeah, in general, people invented the idea of having a doctor, or in like medieval times, a barber who did surgery, or then a lot of times even building a hospital. That came along relatively quickly because it was like, oh, great, we'll do a building with a bunch of beds in it, and that's where we'll deal with sick people. But we did it long before we like figured out how germs work.
Yeah, communicable diseases.
Yeah. You just glancingly mentioned something that I think people probably don't know, that barbers used to haircuts and surgery.
Yeah,
that was one job. It was basically the job of guy with blade.
Yeah,
and that was how
he got the sharp stuff.
They called it, but yeah. Before they figured out barber, they just called him knife guy.
Yeah,
yeah.
Go see the knife guy.
Knife guy cuts hair.
He'll cut your hair, and you'll like
that's where allegedly, this might be apocryphal, but the spinning thing,
the red and white stripes.
Yeah, that's outside barbershops is
candy stripers, right?
Yeah, well, it's supposedly to mimic the white and red bloody rags that were in there. Because they were doing surgery?
Yeah.
Sounds made up.
No, I've heard
As
that.
I say it, tastes like bullshit coming out.
Well, because why would that be the symbol of haircuts?
right, that's true.
Like, the symbol should,
but also, why would you put that out front?
Yeah. You're going to bleed.
You can do it in here or in the street.
Right. I got leeches, you got whatever you got. Yeah. Right. Let's do this.
Have you guys watched the show Steven Soderbergh makes with Clive Owen?
Oh, The Nick? I haven't seen it yet.
No, yeah.
Yeah, that's about early 1900s surgery, and it's just horrifying because, like... Oh. There's no anesthetic, and people are just like,
it's like
this hurts
screaming
so bad.
In his face. In these big operating theaters,
it hurts.
Like everybody's like watching.
It hurts so bad. Right.
It was when like the best thing medical technology could offer a surgery person is a bottle of moonshine.
Right.
Like, great. We have this.
You're going to want to get real drunk for this.
I made it in my yard. You could use that.
Yeah. It's so, in the old movies, it's always like they give them like a little thimble of brandy. Here, take this brandy. You'll need it.
Or, like, right. And like, I would be like, where is the rest of the brandy?
Yeah. I need more of this.
Well, and this is where
sawing my rib bones open.
This is where heroin gets invented.
Oh yeah,
like this is why we needed shit like that, because people were like, "I'm gonna need something stronger than this brandy, chief." Like, I get shit faced on the weekend.
Like, also, it was an era when everyone drank constantly.
Yeah,
so that didn't
just,
like
there wasn't
feel
anything.
One
there
shot.
Were, nobody had hobbies. There wasn't anything else to spend your money on.
Yeah,
just getting drunk.
One of my favorite jobs that used to exist in hospitals is guy who held you down while you had surgery, because the patient was shit-faced and like having his arm sawed off, and so like they were going to try and get up and fucking fight you
all the belligerence of a guy who doesn't want to leave the bar and who's also getting his foot sawed off.
Right.
So they have to have like a pro wrestler in there holding this dude down.
Exactly, that was just a position that existed.
Yeah.
And something else we had talked about on an editorial call, where we're developing a pitch, but early hospitals or like 1900s hospitals, it was a real problem that like the orderlies and the people who worked there were just like constantly shit-faced, and like hospitals had the reputation of being like frat houses. Because the people who work there, I feel like you were on one of those calls, weren't you?
I might have been, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you wouldn't go to the hospital because that was still in the era where you could have a doctor come to you. But like going to the hospital was like the shitty, like slumming it way to get healthcare, because everybody who worked there was just fucking...
They were all nurse Jackie-ing it all the time.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's another... Ooh, that's a good one that I think we've mentioned on the podcast before, but a great screwdriver is actually the anesthesia,
totally.
Because people...
Surgery before that, like what are you doing?
Well, no, but...
was a stick, you bit on it. That was
right. No, but the way that we figured out the laughing gas was a way to knock yourself out was people were throwing laughing gas parties. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
That's what it was invented for in the first place, was people just going out into tents, filling the tents with laughing gas and just laughing their asses off. And then occasionally someone would get too much laughing gas and like break their leg, have a compound fracture. But then everybody would laugh because they'd walk around with their compound fracture and be like, I can't feel anything. And they were like, whoa, that's better than alcohol. And like other times people would take too much of it and just go out and do a deep sleep for like hours and not remember anything.
It's another thing that was invented just by a bunch of rich assholes just being like, hey, we have this thing, yay! And then somebody's like, what the f-?
It's interesting. I had always thought there was no evolutionary benefit to the fact that really smart people who get a lot of wealth then have stupid spoiled kids, but this is it. Dumb rich people.
That's how they figured everything out.
They just invent all this like great shit for
us. What if all the inventors had stupid kids on purpose? I was like, all right, give him some money, all right, let's see what he does. It's gonna be my next great invention.
So hospitals were nightmare carnival of horrors for a long time.
Because for all the people who needed surgery, terrible thing before there was anesthetic or anyone who knew what they were doing, but there were also hospitals existing as a way to, let's get all the people who have just diseases, like we don't need to necessarily do surgery on them, but just all the people with diseases, we can put them in one place and work on them in this one place. It'll be a building full of beds. Great. And they invented that. But if you do that before you know how diseases are communicated, it's like worse to build a hospital. You're just building a building full of people who are going to get each other sicker. And that was how it worked for years and years and years. There's an article on the site that talks about this guy, Ignaz Semmelweis. I might not pronounce that right.
But he was a
Viennese doctor who said, maybe doctors should wash their hands. That's probably a thing. I just saw you do surgery and then go deliver a baby without wiping anything off even. Yeah. Maybe you should, you know, do this differently.
This is why women constantly died in childbirth, is because people would be like, all right, done with this bowel surgery. I'm going to go deliver this baby. And like the woman would get horribly infected because obviously she would.
Yeah, and he said, you know, maybe that's a thing we should work on, maybe that's a thing we should do. And that this was in the 1800s, until then, and partly after then, because no one believed him, that was just what doctors did. They were like, nah, it's transferred by humors or something.
Yeah,
and so obviously, I don't need to, like, clean
malaise.
Up. I'll just do right. Like, when he did that, he was laughed out of the medical community. There was one guy who strongly disagreed with him named Charles Meigs, who said that doctors did not need to wash their hands because doctors are gentlemen, and quote, gentlemen's hands are always clean.
I love that that was their argument.
Fucking asshole. Fuck that guy so hard, man. God damn it, I'm so furious.
Bizarre. When they actually started having doctors maybe start to wash their hands a little bit, it dropped the mortality rate exponentially. Like it's, we just stopped killing kids and mothers by washing hands, which was a great thing.
And likewise, a lot of these ideas, like I think germ theory, there were cultures that had something at least close to germ theory. And we know that the Native Americans were way cleaner than the Europeans when the Europeans came over. And maybe they had some sense that being filthy was bad and that was what got you sick.
Yeah. And a lot of it was trial and error probably. And a lot of it was not based on knowing, well, there are these microbes that get on this. It was just based on, I've seen when we do X and then do Y, you get cholera. Yeah. So don't do X and Y.
There are people who had these good ideas first, but before we had such great ways to communicate, before we had all these fax machines that we're all using, rather than being an advance in medicine where they're like, holy shit, it is germs, and like everybody gets it immediately, the guy who discovers that is in a room with two other guys who are like, ah, I'm a gentleman, that can't be true. And so that idea dies there for like 20 years. Like they were doing root canals and like all sorts of crazy advanced surgery. Like we have evidence of skulls with root canals back in, I think, BC era.
Yeah, and like cancer. Yeah. Like they figured out, like, well, that's a cancerous thing, we got to take it out. Like things like that.
So they had to have had some sense of like, oh, I'm not going to, you know, stick my dirty fist into the wound that I just cut into you. But that was just the doctor who always washed his hands. And then when that guy dies, that idea dies with him because we didn't have this sort of neural network where we could compare notes.
There was no WebMD.
Exactly. And that's what it took. The ability to have a global consensus.
And that's like
incredibly important.
Because it took a long, super long time to catch on, because I had read that that's the main reason why Garfield died, the president, is because when he had gotten shot on the train platform, like all of these surgeons who were there were just like shoving their hands into his back, trying to pull the bullet out on this fucking train platform.
The amazing.
And then it was infected from
that. Yeah, and then he got super infected, and that's what killed him. He like lay in sepsis for like a month.
Well,
and then just died.
The other thing is, they thought, like a lot of people still think because of movies and TV, that you had to get the bullet out immediately. The one thing that's like probably not dirty because it was just blasted out of a gun and so was like made super, super hot and is probably...
It burned
like,
everything
off. Yeah, it burned all the germs off. So you actually don't need to immediately remove the bullet.
Yeah, that's not the top priority.
Yeah, that's just something that they do in movies because it looks rad.
Yeah, it looks
to, like,
super rad.
Yeah.
Like, right.
Yeah.
It's, where it's like the worst, like anybody who gets like a huge like tooth through their shoulder, they always like dramatically yank it out even though it's like what you're not supposed to do because it was like a plug and when you yank it out, it's like all
the They're like grizzled motherfuckers from World War II who still have like five rounds in them.
Right, yeah, like have a...
Right, right.
But
I got six like, Nazi bullets in my sternum.
Yeah, it hurts when it rains. It's like, it's five. But.
Yeah, back when Garfield was shot, they thought, you know, we better get those bullets out of there. Better get those bullets out of you, President Garfield. And like, so they...
Let me scoop my finger in there.
The way that they had for finding the bullet was magnetic. They would put basically a metal detector over him to see where the bullet was. And so they kept digging into him, not realizing that he was laying on a metal table. So they just were
the bullets are everywhere.
Exactly.
How many times was he shot?
We believe the president is a bullet.
Right.
We believe
the president. Yeah. Like, the president is a robot. We just discovered.
Again, that sounds apocryphal coming out of my mouth, but I've definitely read that somewhere reliable.
I remember it was the treatment he received was so bad that was actually part of the murderer's defense, Charles Guiteau. Like, that was part of the thing he said on the stand. I was like, well, I shot him, but the doctors killed him.
Like, yeah. He's like, I barely shot the president.
I only shot him a little bit.
Yeah. The I barely shot the president defense is rarely
that old chestnut.
Rarely successful.
Yeah, I barely shot him.
And also one thing kind of sort of in the defense of these folks not knowing things is that, you know, medicine is complicated in that all kinds of diseases and problems and different things are transmitted different ways and they are different things to know. And my favorite dumb hospital story is from when they were building the Panama Canal. And Dave McCullough has an amazing book. It's called The Path Between the Seas. And it's a great one-volume thing about the history of first the French trying to build the Panama Canal and getting part way, and then giving up and the Americans taking over and doing it. And yellow fever and malaria were both just wiping out thousands of people working on the project. Like about 22,000 French workers died on it, mostly from just disease. And yellow fever in particular, they couldn't figure out, like, how is yellow fever just wiping everybody out? They thought it was through skin-to-skin contact. It turned out that it was actually mosquitoes having it in them and biting people. But since they thought it was skin-to-skin, they built a hospital in Panama very expensively for all the people who had yellow fever and were laid up with it. And then people weren't getting any better in the hospital because they still didn't know what was causing it. But also, when the French built this hospital, they were like, we should have plants in here. That would be nice. It would be a good look. We can do that. But these umbrella ants kept eating all of the plants. And so they're like, well, we need to do something to keep these ants off of these potted plants we've done. Why don't we put just ringed containers of water around the plants? And that just standing stagnant water will keep the ants from eating all these plants. Which it did, but like standing stagnant water, everyone already knew is a great place for mosquitoes to live and breed. And so they were just putting containers of mosquitoes full of yellow fever in the yellow fever hospital because they had no idea what they were doing. And then the French, partly because of money, but mainly because everybody kept dying, had to stop building the canal. And then the Americans came in. And thanks to a couple scientists, but in particular Walter Reed, were just able to figure out the basic thing of, oh yeah, yellow fever is transmitted by mosquitoes. And then since they knew that, they just did things to eliminate mosquitoes and lessen the problem. And the Americans were able to, partly building on the French doing a bunch of digging that they then didn't get to use, were able to build the Panama Canal.
It's like, darn you ants!
Eating the life-giving trees.
They were cosmetic. They weren't like for anything.
They're eating all our plants.
Yeah.
The color green will be good for this, fella.
Yeah.
That'll cure yellow fever.
That'll cure his ails.
Yeah, the color green will cure yellow fever. Yeah, I wonder how often, and I'm sure this isn't how it happened, that America was like, oh, mosquitoes cause yellow fever, you dumb motherfucker. Like, but I wonder how often that actually happened, where like one country has known something for like a thousand years, and yeah. They're just like, are you fucking idiots? Are you serious? You thought that women caused scurvy? You dumb ass.
You daffy bastards.
Because America didn't figure it out right away. It took Americans being down there and also being in Cuba because of the Spanish-American War and just dying constantly of this disease and then having American scientists start to work on the problem. But then once they figured it out, they were like, oh, I forget the book's exact figure, but about a quarter to a third of the digging that the Americans needed to do for the canal was already done by the French, which they had abandoned completely. So it was even like an easier job also because the French were that foolish.
And well, they abandoned the plague lands.
Yeah, they left the Americans, they were like, it. Oh, we can't do anything about this. Yeah. And then the Americans were like, we'll just keep going on what you did, thanks. And had figured it out.
Yeah, it's like, you gonna finish that?
Yeah, yeah.
Can we? All right, cool.
And Walter Reed's rightly remembered for that being a huge advance, like that big medical center in, I think, D.C. is his name for him because,
yeah,
know, what a huge... lifesaver. Yeah.
That's awesome. What a great man. What a bunch of other dumb men. Were you guys saying about belts being a screwdriver?
Belts were cosmetic for a very long time. You know, like military uniforms would wear them primarily just to have something to put the sword on. But at any other time, belts were just worn like around the waist area.
Like, sort of like a WWF champion belt.
Yeah, exactly. Just a belt like looked nice. But the main way of keeping your pants up was suspenders.
Yeah, there's this Freakonomics radio episode where they talk about how once people came up with suspenders, they were like, this is a great way to hold up pants. And it's true. Like it's better for your posture and everything. And you can just strap them on and it's much easier. And
but
yet, belts are...
It looks really dumb.
But right, you associate it with like old timey people or like punk stuff kind of. Or like, it's like if you're wearing suspenders, it's a definite statement.
You're going for like, a look. Like if I walked into the office with suspenders on, Jack would be like, what the fuck are you doing?
Right, right.
Like, all right.
But like all right, man. What is this? You need to go home and change.
What are we shooting? What's the thing? What's the bit?
Are you doing a bit right now?
But then belts, you don't look twice at a man or woman wearing a belt. It's like the one accessory a lot of guys will bother to have at all. On the episode, they even talked to a doctor who says like there's a particular nerve that a belt kind of pinches, especially if you wear it too tight or you wear your pants in a certain way with it. And it's not like the best way we could do it. It's like that Buckminster Fuller thing where he says like when the Titanic sank, people would get on top of piano tops because that was what they had to float on. But like you don't float on a piano top on purpose. It's not like the thing to do. And belts are sort of a thing that we're using because it's common and it seems to make sense.
Like, it's driving on a spare, basically. You're driving on your donut.
Yeah, yeah.
You're wearing a belt.
But it's not the best way to hold up your trousers.
It's like a weird version of the screwdriver where it's like, we got the screwdriver, but then we found this other thing. It's like, well, this looks still cooler.
Right.
We can use that. And it's like, we're like deliberately regressed to this thing that belts don't really work. Like, even if you wear them super tight, your pants always end up sliding down.
They sag anyway, yeah.
It was also because I think it was something to do with the style of the time where the waistline cut on pants started to get lower.
Well, and also that men in general are just physically have very narrow hips. And so a belt is doing a lot of very difficult work. It's like trying to hold around you in a way that you're not necessarily built for. And suspenders are holding up from the top in a way that makes a lot more sense because your hips aren't naturally holding up your pants very much.
My one problem with suspenders is that it feels weird to not have the waist of my pants tight around me. I have a tuxedo that has suspenders, and I always feel like if it started raining, my pants would fill with water because they're just like out and loose. They're like kind of loose at the top a little bit, and it's just kind of hanging there. Like my pants are hanging like a Christmas ornament or something.
I've never worn suspenders, and I think I would feel like that Wallace and Gromit with the wrong trousers, like where he suspenders them on. Like it would feel very goofy to me.
Yeah, you can like look down and see your dick. There's
just,
that just much
hanging
space,
out there.
Which is a plus, but on the negative side,
our dicks are awesome.
Right,
you need to check in with it every now and then.
Yeah. Hey, buddy.
Oh, there it is.
Yeah. Actually, pants in general, we were talking about those possibly being a screwdriver because when you look back through the history of humanity, pants weren't a thing until, I think, Henry VIII. One of his sweet jams was like, how awesome
sweet jams.
How awesome his calves looked. He was like, man, right. I've got some fucking manly ass calves. What a weirdo. That guy has to be one of history's great douchebags. Like, just like, I love my calves, bro. So he started drawing attention to them by wearing pants. There were pants that existed throughout history, like many, many years ago, but they were basically a thing you wore to keep your taint from catching on fire when you rode a horse. It was like, wow, what's Henry VIII doing wearing them horse riding thingies? Which is weird.
He's just like strutting around.
Yeah. Look at them calves.
There's my cat. Boom.
Yeah. So after that point, they took off, and there's like all sorts of political intrigue around pants because the Scottish Highlanders would never adopt them because they were like, fuck you, England. We're not wearing pants. And that's
you
why
your pants.
That's why they have kilts. That's why we have kilts to this day. But it is interesting that for the vast majority of human history, we like had shirts that came tight around the top half of our body, but everything below was just like flowing open to the air. And like, they were like, pants, what are you, a maniac? What are you, a communist?
Yeah. Wear like curtains like the rest of us.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
breezy like, summer curtains.
You can read ancient Greek, some of the more popular writers from back then just like shitting on people wearing pants. Like just being like, nah.
I love it, but yeah. These like great minds were so irritated by pants that they had to like dedicate time to shitting on them.
They were the like man bun or whatever thing we make fun of now of that time.
Yeah, and I think Persians had harem pants at that point.
They had the hammer pants?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, sweet.
So they like wore them sometimes in their leisure, and ancient Greece was
sometimes.
Like, bah! Look at these maniacs! Yeah.
Not too much. It's not a look you want to overdo.
Ancient Greece was like, we're going to oil up and fight them naked. That's how we're gonna destroy those pants wearers.
Yeah, that's the way we'll protect ourselves in battle. One thing I was mentioning over emails, I think we're like in a screwdriver period still with the justice system. And this is something we talked about on the podcast in the past, but just the outdated carnival of horrors that our current justice system is just bizarre. I just feel like eventually this is something that history will look back on and just be like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, you guys had iPhones and you still put people in solitary confinement? It's like the most effective way to drive someone crazy.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. John McCain said the physical torture was nothing compared to solitary confinement. Like,
right.
That was the hardest thing, was maintaining my sanity while in solitary. And they've done tests on people who have spent a lot of time in solitary. They come out crazy as fuck. And so we're taking people who already might be fucked up, some of them innocent, by the way, because, like, as we've discussed, the methods for determining guilt are still pretty fucked. But we're taking these people, occasionally some of the most violent people we have in society, and putting them in basically a crazy chamber.
Yeah, like, put them in the crazy box.
Yeah, give them the scarecrow gas. And then like sticking them there for a couple of months and then being like, all right, you got out on parole, kiddo. Yeah,
you're free to rejoin society.
Yeah.
At this point, he's eating his shoelaces.
Yeah, and this is this is why we have the worst recidivism rate. Whereas there are other countries who, when someone commits a crime, they like take you and they're like, all right, man, this is why you fucking don't do that. And they like look at their methods for like teaching people how not to commit crimes, and then people learn not just how to go forward and be a good person, but they also learn why what they did was wrong and they feel bad about it, rather than just going into a place where they're taught to be even more hard and like emotionally distant from the outside world.
Yeah. We're gonna take this person who already has a little potentially violent tendencies and then just condition them to behave like an animal.
Right.
Like,
right.
Just like a caged animal.
We'll put them in a space where joining a gang along the lines of their ethnicity is probably a good idea.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
We'll teach them to hate everyone who looks different from them.
Right.
That'll reinsert the trick.
Problem solved. We're very beholden to foundations in America. We're very, very resistant to change the foundation of any of our various systems. Like, anytime there's a question about a constitutional amendment, it's very, very difficult to get across because we're so beholden to, well, no, the Constitution says this. It's like, well, yeah, but that's very, very old, and obviously a lot of it doesn't work anymore. So it's like with the prison system and like with education, just with a lot of ways that things work, it's just like You know, growing up, we all had some shitty old thing that our dad insisted wasn't broken. He would just, like, keep nailing things to it to make it. No, it's fine. We just got to fix this hole right here. But it's like, that's not the problem. The problem is the frame itself is completely destroyed. That old swing set in the backyard.
Right.
It's, like, fucked. But he just keeps,
broke
like...
Broke my arm again, Dad.
it's fine. I just need to put a new rope up there. It's like a rusted chain.
Or even that thing they're convinced is good for us. Like, I think past podcasts talked about milk being...
Yeah,
like a thing that is given to you as a thing, like, you, if you don't get this in you 3 times a day, you will die. And it's not necessarily like that. It's not good for you other than the calcium.
Yeah, we've talked about this before, but I will never get tired of mentioning it because it's very important. There's only been a huge drop in the rate of heart disease and obesity once in American history, and it was during World War II. And they went back and looked at, like, okay, what changed?
Rationing.
The one thing was that they rationed dairy. People had less dairy and less meat, and people stopped dying of heart disease. And then when World War II was over, it went right back to the high levels.
Yeah.
But the thing that makes sense about that is, it's like you said, it's not necessarily a character of the individual people. Individual people are all about individualism and, like, making their own decisions. But it's a characteristic of the system in that because we started out drinking milk, those people made shitloads of money, and now they have lobbyists who can continue to pay shitloads of money to control the message to make it seem like milk is still good for us.
All the nutritional guidelines are made by food lobbyists.
Yeah.
They're like, well, we need to push cheese. Well, tell people that they need to eat more cheese because it's good for them. So we had that huge thing, I think, towards the end of the 80s where they were really pushing cheese just because they needed to move some cheese.
Right. That makes me imagine alternate Americas where just different lobbyists were better at their jobs.
Yeah.
Like, the sushi lobby was amazing at it. And so we're all like, well, you got to get sushi twice a day.
It seems like a ridiculous scenario, but the sugar lobby.
Oh, sure.
The people who lobby for sugar is very, very good because to this day, we still don't see on nutrition labels, there's no percentage of your daily value for sugar. It's just blank. They list a percentage of how much you should have per day for every single thing except sugar.
Except sugar, yeah.
Because sugar, it's very, very low amount.
Because on any item, that would be like 12,000%.
Right, like I think the American Heart Association says that you should have something like no more than like 30 grams of sugar. It's like less than a bottle of Coke.
Right.
And not like
right.
a 2-liter bottle, like a personal serving bottle.
Right.
You should not be having that much. An adult man should not be having that much sugar in a single day.
A great example of how, like, wealthy interests maintain is in the 70s there was like a health kick, like hippies started gaining some amount of traction, and there's this health kick.
Your listeners are robbed of, of Jack's miming of hippies.
Very, very loose flapping hands.
Yeah.
Hey man, we're all good. And so skim milk and 2% milk and things like that became a thing. And that left dairy farmers with excess milk fat. And so they then put it to their messaging people and the food industry. How do we get rid of all this excess milk lard? And that's where the cheese boom came from. It was just like, we'll unload it into these people's gullets through cheese.
Cheese.
Yeah. And
turns out it melts on everything.
Right.
If you've never seen those ads from this push in the 80s, they're fucking hilarious. Because it's just like, they're selling the concept of cheese. Like,
right.
It's just like, cheese. It's like a kid with all these wheels of cheese.
Yeah, just taking bites out of it like it's a fucking apple. So that was like their direct approach. And they were like, the cheese ads aren't working anymore. And so that's when they went to fast food makers and the other wealthy people. And they were like, hey, you're good at tricking people into eating shit.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's where you get double, triple cheeseburger things. And also when Domino's was like, our bad, our pizza tasted like shit. Sorry about that. We fixed it. The way they fixed it was tripling the amount of cheese that's in Domino's pizza. Their crust has cheese in it. Like, everything has cheese.
Right,
their sauce has cheese. Their sauce is just red cheese. Anyways, we got a little sidetracked there, but those are all good details on...
Like, how devoted we are to the way that things work, just how...
We'll stick without a screwdriver for a long time.
Yeah, and it's amazing. It's taken us this long to even like start making some traction on nutrition, which you're seeing in these stories about McDonald's is really in trouble because millennials don't like to eat shitty food that's bad for them.
Yeah.
And the reason is because the internet was invented, and now we
it's a free distribution of information now.
We know how to find out that food is actually poisoning us and addictive.
All the headlines are like, why aren't they eating? Like, they can't figure out why they're not
eating. McDonald's going to trick this generation into eating poison? Like, that's essentially what the thesis of those articles is.
Oh, to have a Don Draper millennial.
They're going to have to knock them unconscious and steal their money.
We're going to have to browbeat these kids and eating garbage somehow.
Right. Yeah, I think that's relevant because that's how long it took for nutrition to make some progress. And now I think the next thing that's somehow going to have to make progress is the judicial system. Like, they're both crazy important things. It's like the shit we put into our body that we then become. Like, you literally are what you eat. The cells in your body regenerate every, like, 10 years. And the thing that they're making themselves out of is the food you eat. So, like, no shit, we're, like, extremely unhealthy after decades of having shit shoveled down our throats according to whatever is going to make corporations more money. But the thing that we're not paying attention to, and that maybe the next millennials, whatever the fucking their kids' generation's name is, maybe they'll be worried about the justice system, because it is, like, fucking barbaric.
We're starting to see that.
Yeah.
Now that it's going to be the torch that the next generation bears.
Yeah. It was an interviewer speech, but Rahm Emanuel, who's the mayor of Chicago now, they were saying homicides, which are already crazy high in Chicago, have gone up in more of your time as mayor. Mayor Emanuel, how did that happen? And he said it's because he says police there are afraid to act because there's so much publicity and so many ways to film on your phone police brutality and things going wrong.
But
which a lot of people have said, Rahm, cops should just do their job well.
Right.
But,
cops don't prevent many homicides.
Right.
Yeah. But like, he's one of many people who are noticing that. I think that hopefully things are starting to shift.
And he's reacting by being like, No, don't shift that way.
Don't shift.
Yeah. But I'm the mayor. See? I'm in power.
Well, and also he's the mayor of the city with Home and Square. Adam Todd Brown's talked about it a lot in his column. Like, it's essentially the model of a CIA black site, but in the middle of Chicago, and just they would bring suspects there and get confessions out of them, or just hold them without letting anybody know they were there, letting them have any lawyers. And it happened before Emanuel too, but the governor of Illinois had to just suspend capital punishments because they couldn't trust any of the big confessions they had on a lot of those crimes.
Yeah, it's like Guantanamo Bay for American citizens.
Yeah.
In Chicago.
In downtown Chicago.
And just in general, by the way, you can be held without cause for as long as they fucking want to keep you. We were covering this guy who was arrested and held in prison, but he was, like, wrongfully arrested. They just, like, brought him in because he looked like the guy that they were looking for. And he was in jail for, like, 750 days. So basically, they take you, they hide you away somewhere, and if you don't have a lot of money, enough money for your family to pay some rich guy to be like, all right, I'm going to go look for him, you're fucked. Stay there in this, like, closet for fucking 700 days.
We've written about people that were put in jail and then they forgot about them.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, you know, poor people who just, like, nobody raises
for
a fuss.
30 years. Like, literally, they forgot about them for 30 years. Yeah. And there's, like, tons of people who have been executed who were then exonerated due to DNA evidence because the court system doesn't work. It's insane. It's almost like when you look at how juries determine a case, it has nothing to do with the facts necessarily. It's like, well, he was wearing glasses, so he seemed like a smart fella, probably smart enough to plan this murder.
Yeah.
So lawyers know that, and they're just studying basically human perception and, like, the flaws in human perception, finding out ways to trick people into a conviction or not a conviction. So it's like, again, it comes down to who has the most money to pay the better lawyer to trick the juries the best. And then I feel like the jury system, like, the fact that juries convict people and send them to jail, even though it's, like, a bullshit way to decide if someone's innocent or guilty, and is like a mafia guy being like, all right, if you're going to join my gang, you got to kill someone, because then you're complicit in the thing. By forcing every citizen to do jury duty, it's like, hey, man, you said he was guilty. You know, it's like the system just being like, blood's on your hands, jury. You said OJ didn't do it.
And we've been doing it forever. Like, if I'm correct, it's one of those American judicial things that goes back to British judicial things, which goes back even for, like, it's a system that we've said, this is great. This is right. exactly yeah. how we should do it.
It just, like, sounds like a good idea if you think about it, like, if you squint real hard and cross your eyes, kind of.
Right.
Like, it seems like, oh, yeah, I can see the basic logic in that, but it doesn't work. Like, we know this now. It doesn't work. And that's the best case scenario, that you get tried by a jury of your own peers. The worst case, like, most people, their lawyers are like, you're gonna have to plea out, man. This isn't gonna be good for you, because you're otherwise you
juries are stupid,
right? So. Juries are stupid. They don't like guys who look like you, or you know, women who look like you.
Well, and but of course there is also the cases where they're like, there's just too much evidence. The lawyer's like, all right, you clearly did this, so,
right?
No, yeah, some of the time it's that, yeah, for sure, yeah, yeah.
Oh yeah, like it's not,
yeah, yeah,
it's not 100% bad, but there's gotta be better
but
ways.
Yeah, there's definitely. Yeah, people have been forced. I think we've written about a couple of cases where that's happened, where a person was later exonerated, but it's a problem because they pled guilty, but it was because they didn't have any choice. It was like, I was encouraged to do this. This is the best outcome I had. So the person's in jail for a long time, and they figure out later, like, oh, with DNA evidence, oh, that dude wasn't even there. But it's like, he's already kind of screwed.
Right.
Because he admitted to the crime. So it's
because
because
they offered a plea deal that, because of factors, one among them, juries can be stupid. He was like, I guess I should take this plea deal.
Yeah. If you sign this confession, you only get 3 years, but then your life's over after that.
Yeah.
So you're going to have to commit crimes in order to,
right.
like...
Because you won't be able to vote. It'll be difficult for you to get a job. So you're going to have to start robbing people.
Right.
Also, you've been in solitary for 3 years.
So you'll probably be crazy by the time you get out. Yeah. If you're a little bit mouthy to the prison guards once you go in there because you're pissed off that you got wrongly convicted of this crime. So on that happy note, you guys have anything else?
I mean, I had the idea of air compressors.
Air compressors being like
an ingenious iPhone. Yeah.
Well, I don't even know what those are.
Yeah. Well, it contributed to what Alex was talking about earlier about people moving out west to open movie studios, and also people being able to go down south, because there weren't a whole lot of people living in what they call the Sun Belt before you had air conditioners, because it was just not lit. It was too goddamn hot.
Where's that?
In the south. I forget where the exact cutoff line is.
Like, I can't imagine living in Arizona without air conditioning. New Mexico, I can't imagine.
But it's like, Nevada. There you go.
So we live in the Sun Belt.
It's like if you drew
the Sun Belt and the Snow Belt is just like bisecting the country and like being like, everything above here is the Snow Belt, everything down here is the Sun Belt. It basically goes from
the bottom of Virginia to Los Angeles, essentially.
Yeah.
Well, and I feel like when we were talking before about coming home from the war and having kids' Cadillacs homes, I feel like air conditioning was one of those, finally I get this kind of things along
with
that.
In the cars, like they had to have air conditioning cars. But it came about because they were trying to make an ice maker to make ice. And so they figured out that if they compressed a certain kind of gas, they were using like propane and ammonia at this time. But if they compressed a certain kind of gas, it could be cycled really, really cold, and it could be like recycled.
Oh,
like,
wow.
Cooling coils, and that's how they made ice. But you couldn't really use that in a home setting. I mean, they were still making, you know, trying out air conditioners for like a home setting, but it's like a compressed ammonia or like propane. It's
they were compressing the ammonia and propane with their hands, like a snowball. They're like, it's cold.
But
and that was a time of men, real men. They had the strength to do it.
Back then, ice.
Yeah. They crushed that ammonia with their brawn, and out came ice.
Ice maker was a guy in town.
But they had, somebody had to invent basically a gas that would have the same properties but not be dangerous to people. So Freon is actually a gas that doesn't exist. It's an artificial gas. It's owned by DuPont.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, like that's...
They're so rich.
Yeah, they fucking invented that.
So every artificial cooling thing...
Not everyone. They came up with some new ones that DuPont obviously tried to block that were more ozone safe, but that didn't happen until like the mid-90s.
And I still have Freon in my house cooling system.
Yeah. Yeah,
so DuPont owns that.
Yeah, they owned cold for
basically decades. Any combination of, I think it's fluorocarbon. There's a bunch of different, like Freon is just like a blanket term for, there's a bunch of different kinds of combinations that can produce this gas with this property. They had to like invent this gas in order to be able to use air compressors and things like refrigerators and your house and your car.
Wow.
Or else it would just be this fucking propane tank leaking gas into your house all the time. So when they were able to do that, that's what allowed people to be living in the South year round, to have movie studios in California in the middle of a goddamn desert. And, you know, to keep food in the home and things like that. So this is a huge thing that took many people figuring out many things. You had to have the guy figure out how to do the ice maker. Well, I can do it with this gas. And somebody said, well, that's a great idea, but that's really dangerous. So they had to invent an entirely new gas. And then we used that for a really long time.
And that would be a car level invention in terms of urban planning, reformatting how the country is laid out.
I could be speaking incorrectly here, but it probably might have had something to do with expediting highways, interstates being built.
Because they could freeze things and transport them kind of thing?
For trucking off, but also for like just being able to drive a long distance.
Right, because doesn't your engine overheat without...
Well, it'd be horrible to be in the car just as a person.
Yeah, it would just be awful to just do that.
Or you just have all the windows open and you're going 70 and just like...
Why do they call them air compressors? It's just because they're compressing those gases? They're
compressing the gas, yeah. That's what creates
like,
the
gas,
cold.
That's sort of like air. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
But yeah, so it's sort of like, it's an iPhone and kind of a screwdriver because it took them a really long time. Like I said, they didn't develop one that was kind of more ozone safe until the 90s. So you still had these cars driving around that were spitting out this stuff that was really bad for the environment. But it kept things really cool.
Yeah.
It's very comfortable in the car.
It's totally a screwdriver of like cities before simple refrigeration. It's like, how did we even do it? How did that even...
Oh, man.
Refrigeration and air conditioning and everything else.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's
all based on this idea that if you compress certain kind of gas, it makes things cold.
Yeah. Like, it makes sense that people had country houses and stuff because you just want to get out of there. Like,
I'm going to stop breathing poison for the weekend.
Yeah.
My wife's from Pittsburgh, and there's this photograph of Pittsburgh. We went sightseeing the last time we were there, and there are these photographs from like, I think it's like only the 20s or something, like when Pittsburgh's first being built, and it's just like a fucking cloud. Like that's what Pittsburgh looks like.
Black cloud.
Like a aerial view of Pittsburgh is just a black cloud on the earth.
It's Mount Doom. Like, it's just
what's that black cloud that those three rivers are running into? It's just horrifying looking.
Thanks, Andrew Carnegie and the steel industry.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then DuPont. Thanks, DuPont.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. He went crazy and shot Mark Ruffalo.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the guy.
John DuPont. Yeah.
Yeah.
Foxcatcher.
Oh, Foxcatcher.
It's John DuPont. Right. That's who Steve Carell played.
Yeah. Rather than being one of the dumb people who, like, has the type of parties that invent anesthesia, he just, like...
He was just a crazy person. Yeah,
just turned into a fucking creep.
Yeah.
If we had just let him keep going with that thing, he would have, like, invented a new wrestling training thing or something great, but he was just too crazy. Too beautiful for this world.
Yeah.
Team, man, what a time to be alive. You and yours versus me and mine. Are we talking teams? Are we talking teams? Are you switching sides? Wanna come with me? Look at the smile on me. Look at the aisle on me. I do not.
All right, that was our conversation, and that's Big Rings, also off of What a Time to Be Alive. We had to get Drake saying that phrase in there, of course, one of my favorite parts of that mixtape. And with that, on to footnotes. So yeah, first of all, the Cracked article is called Good Ideas It Took Humanity Way Too Long to Come Up With. The Radiolab podcast about Candid Camera is called Smile My Ass. And the Fresh Air podcast is... you know, the Steve Jobs one. I'm assuming here that you guys know how to use Google and I don't have to like spell out the exact web addresses for you. As for music, I wanted to include one for each type of inventions. Ahead of its time, iPhone, of its time, Asteroid Movie, and behind its time, Screwdriver. So we started with the Asteroid Movie, the of its time Jumpman, off of What a Time to Be Alive, which, in addition to being a song on a mixtape by two guys who are just having their moment, whose waves are cresting right now, Drake and Future. Nice try, Future, but you are the present moment in my book, Future. Anyways, the song we started out with, Jumpman, is full of basketball metaphors, which is an idea that seems to be having a real moment right now. There's also the Post Malone song, White Iverson, which is a nonstop basketball metaphor about how the singer is Allen Iverson. And Jumpman is the name of the Jordan logo, and Drake brags that he's flexing on TNT.
and leaving his left hand in the air like Ginobili, which is a hilarious basketball brag. Anyways, that idea that, hey, we'll wrap long recurring metaphors about basketball iconography, where it's not clear if we're bragging or acknowledging the tragic nature of the former athlete's careers, like White Iverson sings about how Iverson never got a ring. Drake brags, I think, that he is texting with Jordan, which would be sort of embarrassing, I think, at this point. Anyways, for The Screwdriver, we listened to The Art of Storytelling Part 4 because it came out in 2007, like I said, 4 years after Outkast's last album. But it sounds like something off their 1998, I think, album, Aquemini. And it's Part 4 of a series of Outkast songs that started on that album. I think I played Part 2 off of Aquemini for you. Parts 1 and 2 on that album are consecutive songs and among my favorite songs by them. And I even missed this song when it came out. And Part 4 almost always means it's too late in movie franchises, except for Rocky. And I'd argue this song, I love it, or I wouldn't play it, obviously. I also think it's appropriate to play a song featuring Andre 3000, who hasn't released new music in ages, possibly because he's acutely aware that everything has its time and moment, and if you're not ahead of the wave everyone else is surfing, you're going to be too late. That's got to be especially hard for him, being someone who seems to pride himself on existing in the future almost as much as future. He didn't name himself Andre 2000s. I feel like this is also kind of what Kanye is dealing with now. Kanye apparently had a complete album last summer that he recorded with Paul McCartney for some reason. He played it for, I think, Seth Rogen in a limo, played the whole thing, which is weird. He released a few songs off of it, which sounded great, but sounded like other music. It wasn't as ahead of the curve as 808s and Heartbreaks and Yeezus. And so he never could bring himself to release it, and the longer he holds on to it, the more behind the times it gets. Anyways, The Art of Storytelling 4 is an instant classic and a good argument for both Andre 3000 and Kanye to get over themselves, because when you're genius level talented, the thing you release might be like The Screwdriver, something that people just didn't realize they've been wanting for years. And we're going to ride out on my iPhone song, the song that was ahead of its time, which was obviously the hardest one to pick by far. I could have gone with The Velvet Underground, who created indie rock and, as the saying goes, only sold a couple thousand records, but every one of those records started a band. I also thought about my favorite songs off Pet Sounds, You Still Believe in Me, and I'm Waiting for the Day, neither of which get a lot of attention from my favorite publications when they write about that album. I'll have to play those songs for you in a future episode. They both have these moments at the end where the song kind of head fakes that it's over and then has this big dramatic return that's just stunning. But to truly be an iPhone, it has to have been a hit at the time. Pet Sounds was not a hit. And the song that I went with is a number one that launched 1,000 imitators and still seems ahead of its time. You've probably heard it 1,000 times on oldie stations, but I want you to listen to the hand claps and the way the backing vocals kind of layer in under the lead vocals at the 30-second point. It's the type of song that makes old people say they don't make them like that anymore, which is usually true because they've found a better way to make them. But in this case, I don't know if they make them like this anymore, but they sure try. So we'll listen to that in a moment. If you're listening to this the day it drops, Monday the 19th, don't forget to come out to UCB Sunset tonight to see us talk about time travel, unless it's sold out, in which case, don't do that or hop in your time machine and go back and buy some tickets, you fool. Thanks to engineer Brett, who you can follow at Brett, R-A-D-E-R. You can follow me at Jack underscore O-B-R-I-E-N. We'll be back next week with more podcast. But first, we're going to ride out on Where Did Our Love Go by The Supremes from 1964. I have never felt more like an oldies DJ. Thanks, guys.
Hey guys, just a reminder that today's episode was brought to you by Lynda.com. If you want to be a better photographer, they've got classes on how to do that. If you want to make your website better, you can learn how at Lynda.com, whether it's learning how to code or how to do graphic design. No matter what you're looking to do, they've probably got a course on it. So go to lynda.com/crack today. That's lynda.com/crack for a 10-day free trial. Thanks, Lynda. Also, today's show was sponsored by Howl.fm. That's Howl.fm. I'm excited to announce that the Howl app is now available on Android. Yes, I'm still excited a week later. And to celebrate the launch of the Android app, the Howl team is organizing a special sweepstakes for Earwolf fans and giving you the chance to win an amazing prize. A 2-night trip to LA for two, travel and accommodations all included. And during your visit, you'll get the chance to visit the Earwolf studios and sit in on a recording of an Earwolf podcast. The contest is open to all Howl Premium subscribers that are currently premium or in a free trial. So whether you're on Android, iPhone, a web user, you can participate. To sign up for the sweepstakes, you have to go to contest.howl.fm and enter your email address. For just $4.99 a month, you'll get access to amazing exclusive content, including all Earwolf, Wolf Pop, and WTF with Mark Maron archives, and all the new Howl Original shows. Howl Originals are brand new shows by your favorite hosts, available only with Howl Premium. The Sklar Brothers, Lauren Lapkus, and Super Ego already have their own Howl Original, and there are new shows coming every week. I even have one called Good Question with Jack O'Brien, and I'm working on a second and third episode as we speak. So get access to all that exclusive content on your iPhone, your Android phone, and on the web for only $4.99 a month. And with the promo code CRACKED, you get a full month Howl Premium free trial. And once you have your account, go to contest.howl.fm and enter your email address for a chance to come out to the Earwolf Studios and meet all the earwolves.
Hello, podcast listeners. Now that your program has ended, why not listen to the best podcast in the universe? Improv for Humans.
Oh, welcome to Improv for Humans with Matt Besser. That's me.
Improv legend Matt Besser and his friends. Take your suggestions.
Three of the best improvisers in the world will be improvising off your suggestions given to me at Twitter, newspaper articles. We're going to crap on YouTube.
And turn them into long-form improv comedy.
Hello, 911. What's your emergency?
Look, I am being harassed by my bank.
Hold on a second. First, I need you to pick a sight key picture.
Oh, jeez.
You can pick a boat. You can pick a candy cane. You can pick a pumpkin.
I'll take the boat. I will take the boat.
Please listen to all the options first, sir. You can pick a block of cheese, or you can pick a wheel of cheese.
Is the
I'm sorry,
I'll
sir.
Take,
that you only had
boat.
You
I'll
only had 5 seconds.
God damn it!
You only had 5 seconds.
God
the police cannot help you.
Listen to Improv for Humans on iTunes, Earwolf.com, Howl, or your favorite podcast app.
This has been an Earwolf production. Executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Adam Sachs, and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.